And we're back for the final leg.
Yeah, please go on.
We're getting there. And we'll throw in a teaser at the end for everyone that's hung in with us so far to really give them food for thought and to boggle their minds just a little bit further. But as we were saying, we've now geometrically reinterpreted the mathematics behind Coulomb's law of interaction, or law of attraction as he called it, and Newton's law of attraction, or gravitational law of attraction. For since they were formulated, people have puzzled over why they have the same mathematical formulation. Because the mathematics never tied back to a geometry until tetrionics, there was no explanation as to why. But in the center, we can see that whether you're looking at Coulomb's law of electric field interaction or Newton's law of gravitational attraction between material objects, we can now generalize that back to our familiar E squared field of interaction. Now, where the E squared fields interact, which is where they overlap, where the energy momenta can point in one direction or the other and affect the force between particles, is always proportional to the distance between the particles. So we have a linear measure of force shown geometrically, which is the square root of the energy of any of the fields, or both fields superpositioning to create a bidirectional force in the case of Coulomb's law. And we also have the kinetic and the magnetic moments for electric charges shown, and we know they're proportional to the distance. So what we now show is that at the bottom right hand side, with the linear forces, they're a result of the square root vector forces, or the linear momentum of any energy triangle, any energy of an EM field, for example. A chem field is the best example that's there, right above it. You can see that the square root is simply a measure of the Lorentz's correction. The faster the particle's moving, the more quanta it'll have. Hence, the frequency of the quanta in the field will increase, and their wavelengths will contract as per Lorentz contractions. In the case of scalar fields, or beta squared, we then have the scalar fields. And the scalar fields in the equilateral geometry allow us to measure kinetic energies, the electric fields of interactions, the magnetic dipole interactions of Ampere's law, etc., that we've spoken about. So we can then generalize it one step further and say that this linear force, or this strength, the strength of interaction between two particles, whether you're measuring it gravitationally or whether you're measuring the charge interaction, can all be related back to the same geometry. And that's what's in the center. We have three material objects, or three particles, with their extended chem fields. We have a positive, a neutral, and a negative, or negative, a neutral and positive, depending which way you're reading it. Gravitationally, we use coupling constant G. Electromagnetically, or charge interactions, we use coupling constant K. They're both inverse squared coupling constants. They have exactly the same geometry between the particles. The only thing that changes is the number of quanta between these particles. So we can relate them all back to an even more basic coupling constant, and that's got the name of alpha coupling constant, or the fine structure constant, measured in many ways. Tetrionics is the first to calculate a value straight from theory based on this geometry. It's another discussion in itself, and it shows where we can go even further than QED, and in fact correct QED using this basic geometric understanding of matter, and more importantly, Lorentz contracted mass energy geometries, or the rider and the wave, the boat and the wake. Depending on how you want to work your terminologies, they're all more or less the same. And in fact, the idea of a boat and its wake is particularly apt, and this is where we'll finalize. I'll finalize in three additional illustrations where I'll reveal something. As you can see, and we're still on 40.15, as you can see with the Lorentz contraction on the left-hand side, Lorentz contraction refers to is a beta contraction, or formula of beta, which is velocity divided by c. This is based on the assumption that nothing moves faster than the velocity of light. It's the founding postulate on which special relativity is based, and it's the basis of how we calculate relativistic mechanics and general relativity and special relativity in particular. We show now that V on C relationship is simply a square root relationship with respect to the equilateral scalar geometry of mv squared or h nu squared. When you look at the general h nu squared or mv squared, there is no reason geometrically for C to be a limiting velocity. It's simply something that we have chosen, and which bears out very well in everyday physical experiments, because we measure with the velocity of light, or the velocity of propagation of an electromagnetic wave. Electromagnetic waves propagate as a result of the cross product of their magnetic and electric fields, their impedance of free space, if you like. And in fact, the velocity of light is only C in free space or in a vacuum. Where light encounters a medium or a changed medium, where the electric and magnetic permittivity changes, the Z factor, the impedance, the velocity of light changes. The velocity of light in water is less than the velocity of light in space. So where the velocity of light is spoken of in tetraionics in particular, but in physics, it should always be referred to as C in a vacuum. Because, as I said, the velocity of light in glass or in water is completely different to the 79248 meters per second that's measured in a vacuum. And this is important. We choose the velocity of light because it's so fast and it's convenient. We shine a beam of light from one end of a lab to another using a laser beam. We measure the distance. We measure the distance to Jupiter and back by timing the eclipses of its satellites. We can use light for a lot of things, but it is not the limiting factor. Light, the velocity of light is determined by the amount of energy, electromagnetic energy, in any region of space. And in particular, it's determined by the density or the impedance of that region of space. Now, with that in mind, if you were to step outside that, and this is where the final three illustrations come in. Illustration 80.10 opens the door. If the velocity of light is determined by its electromagnetic energies per c squared, energy divided by c squared is mass, or its mass energy momenta content, then and the velocity of a particle is determined by its chem field and the mass energies within that chem field, then it's conceivable that if we add sufficient mass energies to any chem field, i.e. release greater than c squared quanta per second into an EM field, we can create sufficient energy momenta in the chem field to exceed the square root of mv squared, or particular hv squared in this case. I'm just talking the chem field, ignoring the matter. So if we have hv squared equals hc squared, we then have a chem field whose square root, linear momentum, can accelerate something to c squared. If we increase that amount of quanta to more than hc squared, say to 4hc squared, we would then have sufficient energy momenta to reach a velocity of 2c. 9 h nu squared will give us 3c. Now I think you can see where I'm heading here. We can then create kinetic EM fields, or weights, waves, think of a tsunami in this case, heading towards a surfboard rider, that will propel the rider to even faster speeds. The key to it will be that the electromagnetic energy will always want to revert back to C, just like a photoelectron, when bound to a nuclei, will want to revert back to the ground state. The energy of a superluminal chem field will always dissipate as a proportion to the inverse square of the distance. But if you release enough energy per second into a chem field, you can accelerate any given particle to speeds faster than c. I suspect that's what happened at the Italian experiment, where neutrinos suddenly were seen to be breaking c, and because relativity was so sacrosanct, they went out of their way for months on end and finally determined it must have been a faulty connector, at which everyone let out a sigh of relief. Relativity was still intact, no problems at all. Nobody went off to duplicate the experiment or to try and prove by pumping more energy into that experiment whether they could move, in fact, other particles faster than C through the same experiment. They simply found a problem, or measured a problem, solved the problem by declaring a faulty connector, and went back to the old way of thinking. Hence, this belief system reinforced the status quo. If you take that, what I've said so far, we now know that rest matter can be accelerated to any velocity, which is the basis of the general formula mv squared. So if we wanted to accelerate a neutrino to c or beyond, we simply have to calculate the energy required on the basis of the amount of matter being accelerated. Neutrinos are the lightest particle there is. We can make them a nuclear reactor as a byproduct, can make them many other ways. We calculate the energy required, and we pump that amount of energy into accelerating the neutrino in a similar experiment, and we will find that we'll move faster than C. Not likely to happen in a huge rush. This is akin to Einstein when he said measure the bending of light near a star. It took him many years to convince somebody, namely Eddington, to go off and do the experiments, to take the measurements. And even then, there was a bit of belief system at work there as well. This is the same sort of thing. We now have a geometric basis, and I'm not just talking about a simple mv squared being stretched mathematically or geometrically to give us an answer to going faster than light. This same geometry is at work with everything in tetrionics, from explaining charge to the topology of matter, to mass energies, to chem fields, to usurping special relativity, general relativity with gravitational fields, chemical models, so far as models of the atom, etc., and many other fields that I've done in my books. It's not just a case of saying this suits me to say we can go faster than light. There's many, many other things. In particular, the new formulation for mass, energy, matter, where we have mass divided by c squared as well as mass by c squared. So now that we can define matter, we know the role of mass energy is this magic carpet. It's the wave that the particles or surfboards can move on. Just as a wave, a gentle wave, can make the rowboats in a harbor move up and down and move towards shore, and a tsunami can pick up the heaviest of boats and move it 20 mile inland, we can now theoretically do the same thing with any size particle. The interesting thing about it is that chem field forms a shield. It deflects other particles that are approaching particle this object in motion. We now know from our understanding and definition of mass and matter that the material ship won't be contracted, won't be squashed in this process. There's still acceleration factors to take account, but you're not getting to the point under the standard model where as you increase the speed, the length of the mass and the matter contract to the point where you get to C, or almost to C, and you're just a dot point. You're smeared out laterally and you have no length. That doesn't occur. What's happening is as you're going faster and faster, you're staying the same, your ship's staying the same. The energy within the chem field is increasing. The wavelength of the mass energy in the chem field is contracting and getting smaller and smaller and smaller, because you're putting more and more quanta into that field per second to accelerate it, to make that field accelerate the matter that it's connected to. But in the process of creating those accelerations, you're creating an electric field that precedes the particle, the ship in motion, to act as a deflector of other charged particles. You also have a magnetic dipole either side of the ship to allow for steering and for other purposes. So there's a lot of things built into this. We're effectively scaling neutrinos up to spaceship size and using that to go from A to B to C to D at faster than light velocities. So that's what the last three illustrations, the second one, superluminal velocities, shows that Lorentz contraction, shows how the particle remains the same size and how the quanta within the chem field grow smaller, and wavelength contraction. And the third one simply shows us that we can, instead of the electron, we just swap the electron for a charged spaceship. We charge the hull of the ship as a positive or a negative, depending on which way we want to go, or what interactions, all these sort of things. The final point that I just want to throw up as a bit of wild speculation is, for a long time, cosmologists have seen gamma ray bursts occurring throughout the galaxies, throughout the universe. And every time without fail, as they swing, observe one or measure one, and then swing visible telescopes to that patch of the sky to see what created the gamma ray burst, a huge burst of energy, sometimes more than what a galaxy releases in a fraction of a second. They swing the optical to where the measured burst was, they see nothing. There's not even a black hole, as they propose, to explain what caused the burst. Because if the black hole was there, or a white dwarf, etc., they would still be there with matter accreting around it and radiating out. When the gamma ray burst occurs, there's a huge burst of energy, electromagnetic energy, and then there's nothing. If you think of what's happening here with a ship accelerating to the speed of light or further, you would naturally navigate for the shortest route. You'd point yourself towards the star you want to go to, and then you release the energy into the chem field. That would be seen at a distance as a huge burst of light, because as soon as you release the energy and you accelerate away, that energy starts to dissipate. It releases itself, and as it spreads out, the wavelengths drop down over greater and greater distances until it becomes visible light, but it's still measured as a huge release of energy. But by the time that light's traveled, say, 1 light year or 10 light years to us, and we swing our telescopes to where we measure that burst of energy coming from, 1 or 4 years, even at the speed of light, 1 or 4 years have passed. That ship is now 1 to 4 years away or towards its destination, nowhere near where the burst was detected. Just throwing it out there for speculation. It ties in nicely with the chem fields propelling. Wouldn't it be interesting if there were advanced life forms out there that have done all this work, developed the ships, and are now buzzing around the universe, quite happy to do so, because they know that if any developing civilization turns their telescopes towards the gamma ray burst they detect, they'll never see anything anyway, because those ships have long gone. That's the final, but it's just an interesting conclusion to what we can do now that we can differentiate mass from matter through charge geometries. I'll pull it up there because we've been talking for a while. This is going to be a big file.
It will be a big file, but it's also a big story. And,
it is.
It's really nice that I started with the metaphor of a surfboard on a wave, and you end up with basically charges and discharges measured in the universe associated with planetary travel, or maybe the travel of planets. The whole idea is that, yes, we need to think in a different manner. And in tetrionics, it is possible to do that. As a result of the distinction between mass and matter, we can now see that in the material structure, the quanta are organized in a very specific manner, as a result of which they will be invariant, they will be structurally inert. But that also means that, in a way, we need to correlate the energy that comes into it, of which the field size can be any size, basically, to what can be connected to the charges of the surface of these tetrions that are the basis of matter. I know that we have more to explore, but in the story of today, you've nicely shown again and again, as also before, that it is so necessary to see that matter, which is inert, and mass or energy, which is composite, need to be compared in relationship to each other, and that we can only see how the two are connected when the electromagnetic fields are understood by themselves, and that the material structures are seen as independent, invariant constructs. And that's also where a lot of what you've described before, in the spectral emissions, in the Rydberg numbers, and the Bohr radius, the Schumann numbers, Schrödinger numbers, all of that comes together in that relationship between the electromagnetic fields and matter. And what is so nice about it is that in the geometry, as you keep on showing, all of that becomes very clear. And then, of course, it's really nice to sort of take us out of the limitations of our customary thinker conditioning by showing that, yes, we need to think about spaceships and science fiction and other stuff, which in the time of Leonardo da Vinci was held to be impossible. But what he conceived at that time is sort of what we live with nowadays, all of us together. And all of it starts with a different way of thinking. So I'm really glad that you are explaining what you've been finding, how you've been finding it, but more specifically, how you needed to think in a different manner, so that we can do that too.
Yeah.
As always, is there a way that you would like to close off this recording?
You summarized quite well. I mean, I'd just like to add that, as you said, tetragonics is initially about thinking about things in a completely foreign manner. But underneath all this foreign thinking and all these strange geometries and terms is one constant, and that is the equilateral geometry of energy. That energy divided by c squared, or energy per light second, is mass, and energy per light second squared is matter, or mass per light second is matter. However you want to dice and chop it, it all comes back to the same geometry. And the guiding light I've always had with this geometry is to follow it. Invariably, when I get off track or I struggle with things, that's when I have to fall back and let the geometry tell me what to do. Despite all the words and the long discussion tonight on this mass fields versus matter topologies, it all comes back to a very simple geometry, and that's these paper templates, making the templates and fiddling around with them. If you do that, you get a very good grasp of what's going on, the planar versus the 3D. Once you do that and you move further on in your thinking, then you can start to visualize the mathematics as a geometry. And then you see the reality of what's going on. You see these immaterial interactions simply as geometries working one against the other. And that's important. Despite all these long discourses that we have, and I elaborate things over and over and over, there's a lot more we can add to this. I've only scratched the surface. I've just basically carved the path, put the geometry down and painted it with pretty colors. It still follows the same mathematics within reason. There are some changes, as you've seen. But for the most part, tetragonics is just a geometric reinterpretation of physics as we know it, which in turn leads us to a new understanding and a higher level of science in the days ahead, months, years, whatever it may take. But this is just the first step on the path, and the more I can elaborate, the better. But this is an important one: mass versus matter, how the field of mass energy accelerates the matter, not the other way around. Physics up until now, since its inception, has been about the study of matter. We're now going from the study of matter into the study of the immaterial mass energies. And that's the important step. We're now seeing a whole new picture of the universe and how it interacts. But it all comes back down to these one and the same equilateral triangles of energy.
Yeah, that's the level of cosmic creation, which in traditional terms would be called spirit. As I mentioned at some other time, we can see the river carrying a log while it floats off the water. We can see the autumn leaves being blown by the wind. And so the old terminology was also that there must be something wind-like, something we cannot see, pneuma or spiritus.
Ether.
Our breath or ether. Basically, we need a word to describe how the physical has moved, and that is precisely the theme of the presentation series that we're now doing. There is something that describes the movement of matter, and in tetragonics, it is very clear to see that that's the electromagnetic field. Kelvin. That seems to be a good place to round it off for today.
I think so.
Thank you again for a very lengthy and very elaborate explanation for it all.
And somewhat long-winded, but
also
it needed to be.
lot of content to this story. So thank you very much for that.
No problems.
As usual, after I hang up, I'll come back to evaluate with you.
No worries.